This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, James Patterson, has sold over 400 million copies of his many books. Those books include the Alex Cross Detective Series, the Women's Murder Club Series, and Maximum Ride. Alex Cross was spun off into three films, two starring Morgan Freeman and another starring Tyler Perry. An Amazon Prime Video series called Cross has been renewed for a second season. Patterson has co-authored books with Bill Clinton and Dolly Parton. His second collaboration with Clinton will be published this summer. Patterson's also written nonfiction books about the Kennedys, John Lennon, Muhammad Ali, and Jeffrey Epstein, as well as books for children and young adults. His new book, The Number One Dad Book, is addressed to new fathers who need some advice. Back when Patterson was starting to write, he took a job as a junior copywriter at the J. Walter Thompson Advertising Agency. He rose to the top, becoming CEO and then head of the agency's North America division. If you're wondering how he's managed to do all this, he typically works with collaborators. Patterson writes an elaborate outline of the story. The collaborators write the sentences. He describes this in more detail in his 2022 memoir called James Patterson by James Patterson. I'd be remiss if I didn't also mention that he's now collaborating on a thriller with the star YouTuber and influencer known as Mr. Beast. As you can guess, Patterson is pretty rich. He's also a generous philanthropist, donating over $7 million to schools and classroom libraries around the country, establishing over 400 teacher and writer education scholarships at 21 colleges and universities, and giving over $2 million to independent bookstores. In recognition of his work, on May 14th, James Patterson received the Lifelong Learning Award from WHYY, the public radio and TV station where Fresh Air is produced. That was the occasion for our interview, which we recorded in front of an audience.
Hi, I'm Stephen King. I'm here to honor James. I love the guy. What can I tell you?
First of all, congratulations, and thank you for doing this interview.
I am not worthy.
So, in your memoir, you describe how you hear voices in your head basically telling you stories. I'd really like to know what that feels like, but what that experience
No, you don't.
Is like.
You think you do, but...
No, I do.
Until the voices won't stop, and they keep you up at night. You know, it's an interesting thing. You talk about voice. All these books have a different voice. The Father book has a voice. The autobiography has a voice. Alex Cross is a different kind of voice. The kids' books, different voices. I've learned not to, like, get up in the middle of the night anymore.
And start writing?
Pretty much. Sometimes I do write, so.
So another thing that I learned from your memoir, which I found really fascinating because it's so different from the work that you do and from the stories that keep coming to you in your head. Mm. When you were young, before you became a writer, when you first became really interested in reading, you read a lot of Thomas Merton, who was mm-hmm. the now famous Trappist monk.
Yeah.
Who wrote the bestseller Seven Story Mountain, which was kind of required reading for a lot of people in college, like in the 60s and 70s. But anyway, you actually went to the monastery.
Yes, in Kentucky, yes.
That he lived in for many years. And I think you seriously considered becoming a Trappist monk.
No, I didn't. I didn't do that. But I was in graduate school. I was at Vanderbilt, and I was kind of wandering around thinking about it was during Vietnam, so it was a scary time for anybody in school or not in school. And I decided to go up there and I just kind of showed up. It's kind of interesting because the Trappist monks, you know, they're not supposed to really talk, but they have one.
Yeah, they don't talk.
They have one priest or brother who will greet people that come in. And I remember I talked to him. He said, "Well, why are you here?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm doing a little too many drugs and, you know, whatever. And I just need to kind of straighten my life out a little bit." And he said, "James, you know, life is like a game of football. And you run down the field, but if you step out of bounds, you know, the score doesn't count." And at that point, I just wished that he had maintained the silence rather than giving that. They did let me stay. They let me stay for about 10 days. And I left there saying, okay, if I want to be a writer, I have to do certain things, and I'm going to do this somehow, or I'm going to try to do it. But I needed that 10 days to really sort of think it through and focus on it. And focusing is a big thing. You mentioned the autobiography. And especially at my age, I think it's semi-interesting to me anyway. And I wrote it during COVID, but I became a better writer writing that autobiography. I concentrated on the sentences more than I had in a while, which is really important for me.
Well, one of the things I find interesting about spending 10 days in the Trappist monastery is because they practice silence and because you're always hearing stories and voices in your head, and both the silence and the need to like write, to always have like more words and more stories seems so kind of opposite from like the attention to silence in the monastery. So it seemed so different from what your nature is.
I just wanted to think, and I mean, they're not in totally silent. I mean, they sing. It's a fascinating life. I mean, they go to bed at like 7:30. They get up at 3 or so. They have a mass or whatever, and they sing a lot. And they're all very healthy, at least they were in those days. And then they go out in the fields, and then they come back and have these very Spartan meals. And I just found it was a time to really put my mind at peace and ease and think things through.
Yeah. You mentioned you were doing too many drugs.
Yeah.
How did being an usher at the Fillmore East figure into that? And for anyone who doesn't know the Fillmore East, that was the East Coast equivalent of the Fillmore West, which is where they had all of the like psychedelic concerts, you know, whether it was Grateful Dead or the Jefferson Airplane, I think they were there.
And Jimi Hendrix, the Doors.
The Doors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My job there was not to take drugs. and it wasn't that I was a massive drug user, and I pretty much always had things in control. But it just seemed to me that if I really, and my grades are always good, but I needed to just focus more was the main thing. But at the Fillmore East, I also was at Woodstock. Now, everybody I know my age says they were there, but they weren't because I looked around. And but the Fillmore East, I did that for a couple of years. And actually, Robert Mapplethorpe was one of the ushers.
You're kidding.
No. I knew him a little bit back then. And actually, one of the stories in the book, which was so great, after one of their shows, and they were all sitting in the front. I think there was two shows that night, and they were sitting there with Graham, who ran Fillmore East and Fillmore West, and a bunch of the ushers. We were sitting behind them a few rows, and Jim Morrison. He looked. It was a three-story theater. And he looked up there, and all these lights were hanging over the seats in the front. He said, "Bill, that's really dangerous. Those lights would come down and kill people." And Graham's going, "You're Jim, just relax. The lights are not coming down. You know, it's we're going to be fine." And then Morrison just stormed off. And about 10 minutes later, we hear this voice, and somebody's screaming. We look up there. This is a true story. And Morrison is hanging from the lights. He goes, "You're right, Bill. It's okay. These lights are all."
So people are always wondering, like, how do you do it? How do you write so many books?
Yeah.
And the answer is you collaborate.
Well, that's part of the answer.
Part of it is
you love to do it. Somebody said you're lucky if you find something you like to do, and then it's a miracle if somebody will pay you to do it. But even before people were paying me to do it, I just loved it. And actually, it was working at McLean, the hospital, which is when I started writing. I would go into Cambridge and buy. I went to a Catholic high school, and they just gave us a lot of books that none of us liked. But when I moved up there, I started reading a lot of stuff, the kind of stuff I hadn't read before, and I was loving a lot of plays, short stories, and a lot of novels. And then I started scribbling, and I loved it. I just loved telling stories. And I think I grew up in the woods, and I used to, as a little kid, I would go out in the woods and tell myself stories. And story after story after story after story. And I think that, and I remember actually when I used to get down to Vanderbilt, I would drive down there from Massachusetts. It would take like 26 hours or whatever. And I used to write Broadway musicals in my head, driving down to, you know, and sing the songs. It was crazy, but, you know,
the music,
might notice a pattern.
The music
here.
And lyrics?
Sort of the music, yes. Yeah. I would always put a tune to it, whatever I was, you know, and the storyline, whatever the heck it was. And it would just, you know, I don't know, but it was fun. I liked it.
At what point in your writing did you think that it would be helpful or a good idea or more productive or whatever to work with collaborators? And then maybe you can explain your process for doing that.
Yeah, you know, I don't know why people find it so extraordinary. First of all, in advertising, which I hate to go back to that prison, but in my mind, it's very collaborative. And you generally work with an art director and maybe a producer, and the two or three of you will sit in a room and you create these little stories, little films usually. And that is collaborative. You know, Sistine Chapel, all these, you know, some famous doing this thing on the, you know, 5, 10, whatever number. collaborative. My own theory is if we're going to save the world, we'll have to somehow figure out to be collaborative, or AI will probably figure it out for us and either save us or destroy us, depending on, you know, the mood that day. It just seemed a natural thing to me. And the first one actually was a little golf book, and it's a guy that I knew from the advertising days. And after we played golf, we just started chatting about a story that I had. And we said, well, let's just try this. And we wrote Miracle on the 17th Green. And then after that, I just said, you know, well, I can do this. This will be an interesting thing. And I don't remember the first one. It might have been a Women's Murder Club where I collaborated, the second or the third book. Andy Gross, who, wonderful guy who just died. It was so tragic.
Yeah, I read the obit.
Oh, my God. You know, just and he's such a healthy-looking man, you know, and a wonderful person. At any rate, that was very sad for us. And obviously, it's tragic for his family.
You describe yourself as being like the storyteller, but you enjoy telling the stories, writing, yeah, you know, coming up with a story. It's, yeah, doing like a very elaborate
30, 40, 50 page outline.
Yeah. And then
no,
doing several drafts.
This tour, I'm working on three outlines.
Yeah, boom, but yeah, then yeah, you leave this actual sentences in
the
book.
Well, you see what happens to Alex Cross, I got to tell you.
But you leave the sentences in the book to the person you're collaborating with. At what point did you think that you'd stick to the stories and leave the sentences to someone else? Correct me
well,
if I'm getting
no,
that
no,
wrong.
No, I didn't. I mean, a lot of times, especially in the beginning, no, I would go in and do two or three drafts in mm-hmm. the beginning.
Yeah.
Not as much now,
mm-hmm.
Because most of the people I'm working with, they kind of know the joke, but I'll still come in and rewrite. I mean, the most insane thing was when I did the book shots, which were novellas, which I still think was a very valuable thing to do. So the stores would have these, you could read these books in a couple of hours, like a movie. They were novellas, 100 pages, 100, whatever the heck. And I think it's a useful thing. The publishers were afraid of it because, oh my God, people are going to buy these $7 books and they won't buy, well, they will buy longer books, but you're just going to have more people and some of them, that's all they have time for. They have a couple hours and they want to, you know, it's like a movie, you know. But the year I did that, I wrote 2,400 pages of outlines in addition to two full books. So, and then that's one of the things that people are looking at, you know, what I do, and they go like, well, and they always project their own situation. And people are sort of funny that way. Like with this, the dad book, How to Be a Better Dad in 1 Hour, I'll talk to these various people who interview you, and they go, what's the one idea? And I go, there isn't one idea. The whole idea of this book, there's so many things dads can work on, and they just need to figure out the things that pertain to them. And the reason it's 1 hour is because most dads will not read the 400-page book. So what I did is just try to, and that's not a joke, but it's serious. I mean, because I wanted to be pragmatic about it. And what I've heard, and I've never had this experience before, but especially women who read the book and they'll say, I'm giving this quite seriously to my husband, quite seriously to my dad, and quite seriously to my two goofy brothers who are dads and really need help. And guys do. Guys need help right now.
Are these things that your father did or did not do for you?
My dad, the only time, and this isn't totally true, but my only hug I ever got from my dad was on his deathbed. And he apologized, and he cried, which he never did.
Apologized for not hugging you or for something else?
He apologized for just not being as close as he thought he should have been.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said, you were a great dad. You're a great dad.
Was he?
He grew up in the Newburgh poorhouse. It was called the Pogey. His mother was a charwoman there. His father had disappeared. He never knew his father. And he didn't have the experience to be a dad, you know. So, you know, that's fine. And I did therapy for 1 year, and I got in touch with, and I just don't blame him. It was fine. He did the best he could. I have a friend. His whole thing is doing the best you can religion. You're doing the best you can. Okay, that's good. God bless you. You're doing the best you can. Okay.
What did your father end up doing to make a living?
Well, the last thing he did after he retired at 60, 61, he actually wrote a novel. It didn't get published, but it was pretty good. It was pretty good. And that's what he wanted to do. He went to Hamilton, which is to go from where he was, the poorhouse, and to get into Hamilton, unbelievable leap.
Sure.
He was a bright guy. He didn't have a lot of confidence. You know, he just didn't think he could. He sold insurance, and then he actually did well. He worked for Prudential. He did well in the insurance stuff. But he didn't have the confidence. And he didn't instill confidence in myself or my sisters either, which is unfortunate. But my grandmother, she was the one, she said, listen, I'm going to be real about this stuff. You're not going to play in the NBA, so forget about that. You don't go to your left very well. You're good. I could dunk in high school. There's a little white guy that could dunk. But you're not going to make it. But you are going to be able to do stuff. And she had one of the lines, which I use it in, on Substack, is hungry dogs run faster. That was one of her things. And the other thing was just go out and chop wood. Do it. Don't, you know, stop talking about writing your book. Go write the damn book. Seriously.
So I want to ask you about your Alex Cross series, which is like your longest running series of books. Yeah. Did you know that you'd be capable of writing mysteries and thrillers?
No. And I, somewhere in there, I think it was when I was at Vanderbilt, I read, and I didn't read a lot of commercial novels at that point, but I read Day of the Jackal and The Exorcist, and I went, ooh, these are cool. I like these. And maybe I could write something like that. The novel that had knocked me out, 100 Years of Solitude, and I said, I'm not capable of that. I thought I could write a literary, but I said, I don't really want to do that. I don't want to write for those people, honestly. I'm not interested in those kinds of stories. But I said, I could do something like Day of the Jackal, maybe. But I can't do 100 Years of Solitude. I don't have it in me. And yeah, that's what I'd like to do. But, it's like, you're not going to play in the NBA. Sorry.
Yeah.
I didn't have the confidence. Mm-hmm. And that's a big deal. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, down there was a professor, and I took one writing course, and he said, you have it. You have that. And he was a real conservative Southern guy, and I was the hippie with the long hair and the whole whatever. I wish I had the long hair now, but, and that was a big confidence builder. That was huge for me, huge. To have a professor, to have a published novelist say, you have, Peter Taylor was another one. Peter Taylor, he read some of my stuff, but you have it. A really good short story writer who was at the University of Virginia.
So another question about religion. We talked a little about the Trappist Monastery that you spent 10 days in and how it helped you decide to be a writer.
Yeah.
Do you maintain any form of religion in your life? If that's not too personal to ask.
Yeah, no. Something, some connection that, certainly the idea that things are bigger than me, which I think that isn't necessarily religious, but I think I think it probably has its basis back in growing up Catholic, and there are things more important than you. And whether that's a society or whatever the heck it is, or your family. So I've always had that.
You were an altar boy.
I was. I'd served Mass every day for like 2 years in a row. This is when I don't know how old I was, 9, 10 years old. Yeah.
What did it mean to you?
Well, I think in those days, and I think like a lot of kids, I thought about maybe I'll be a priest. That might be an interesting thing to do. I certainly respected the priests and the brothers and the nuns and what my mother taught in the school. We had, priests and brothers in our house all the time. They wrecked two of our cars.
Oh, really?
a little too much wine, whatever, I don't know. No, yeah, honestly, Oh, he hit a fire hydrant. Okay, that's okay, Father, no problem. And we didn't have money either. I mean, that was the other, like, oh, no. And my father was not Catholic, so he was especially not keen on that.
So, I just really appreciate, like I think so many, many, many people do, all the philanthropy you've done, the support of literacy, the support of independent bookstores, scholarships, funding school libraries. One thing I find especially endearing, which you've done, is giving bonuses to independent booksellers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And librarians a little bit too, yeah.
Yeah, that's such a nice touch because I'm sure they're all not paid very well. And it's such a personal thing to do. It's like acknowledging not just the institution or an abstract and like loving reading. It's honoring the individuals who do the work.
Yeah.
And how did you come up with that?
I don't know. But the other piece of it, which just to your point, to your point is I get the nicest notes from people. Of all the things I do, they'll send these notes. And some of them, for the first time in 3 years, I gave my parents presents this year or I went to the dentist because of the, And it's real and it's honest and they're so appreciative. And so that's a nice thing.
James Patterson, I want to thank you for this and congratulations on the Lifelong Learning Award.
Thank you.
James Patterson's latest book is the number one dad book. The new novel he wrote with Bill Clinton will be published later this summer. Our thanks to WHYY's Nancy Stuskey, Allie L'Esperance, and Yvette Murray. This is Fresh Air.